Welcome to Dead Souls Social Club.
Now I am become death, the destroyer of souls.
If you enjoy our show and you find our research interesting, please leave us a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform. Something that small really does go a long way in helping us out. You can find more about us and the research that we do by heading over to Instagram and searching our name. As always, thank you so much for joining us tonight. This is a Dead Souls special report. The AI problem.
Our scientists have done things which nobody's ever done before.
Yeah, but your scientists were so preoccupied with whether or not they could, they didn't stop to think if they should.
In the simplest terms, artificial intelligence, abbreviated as AI, is intelligence exhibited by machines and/or software, particularly computer systems. It's a current field of research within the realms of computer science, whose purpose it is to develop and study methods and software which will enable machines to perceive their environment and use learning and intelligence to take actions that maximize their chances of achieving defined and specific goals. AI technology is at the forefront of science and technology, with a massive and cutthroat race to be the pioneer or controller of the technology. Industry, government, and science are all vying for this pole position. You will no doubt have heard a lot about AI, either in science fiction movies from the 1980s and 1990s, like The Terminator or The Matrix, or from media reports over the last few years. You see, during the 1980s, computers were quickly becoming everyday and common items, new to the population who had only seen them as high-tech industry machines prior to this. With the introduction of computers into common culture and people's homes, so the public paranoia about their capabilities in the future grew. Hence the emergence of artificial intelligence and dystopian futures into the common zeitgeist, and in particular, science fiction movies, books, and television shows of the time. The fear that computers would become self-aware, smarter than humans, and be able to take over and control mankind slowly grew at a time when the Cold War had already planted anxiety and paranoia into the cultural psyche. Then, before we even knew that the stark reality of AI was creeping up on us, it actually arrived. But it's not here in the way that we were expecting, and it's not a danger to us in the way that we were expecting. Although, let's be very sure about this, it is a significant danger. Over the last 30 years, computers have become integrated in almost all aspects of our everyday lives. They are within our homes, stores, schools, banks, hospitals, out in the street, railways, airports, parks, and almost all workplaces. Computers operate refrigerators, televisions, laptops, smartphones, toasters, automobiles, public signs, toothbrushes, toys, bicycles, beauty products, billboards, and even our clothing. Software is all around us, and we have become more and more dependent on it to function in society and live the quality of life which we expect and desire. Alan Turing, the British mathematician and computer scientist, was the first person to conduct substantial research into the field of machine intelligence. This would later develop into what we know today as artificial intelligence. Funding and interest in the field, while fairly dormant for a number of decades, vastly increased after the year 2012, when deep learning surpassed all previous AI techniques. Technology had finally reached a point where computer storage, processing power, and speed and learning algorithms could match that of a human adult in specification. It was only a matter of time before scientists and researchers provided the tools and blueprints for engineered intelligence to evolve, replicate, and learn in significant volume. Due to this increase in private funding and new interest in research, the Transformer architecture was developed in 2017, which directly led to the AI boom of the early 2020s. The Transformer architecture was made possible by more than a decade of social media data harvesting and fine-tuning of human algorithms. In the United States and the United Kingdom, companies, universities, the military, and scientific research laboratories pioneered remarkable and momentous advances in artificial intelligence. The advances in AI in the 7 years since 2017 equate to more than the previous 30 years combined. That's how important the transformer architecture was to the industry. The growing use of AI is influencing a shift towards increased automation, data-driven decision-making, and the integration of AI systems into various economic sectors and almost all areas of life. It will, if it hasn't already, impact job markets, healthcare, industry, government, military, and education. Whilst our future won't look like the Terminator movies, with vicious and almost indestructible humanoid robots trying to destroy us, rest assured, the reality will be more subtle in its delivery, but the outcome just as catastrophic, if we allow it to be. Many observers and critics of the development of artificial intelligence state that the long-term effects and risks that AI poses, as well as its ethical implications, require regulatory policies to be implemented to ensure the safety and benefits of the technology, and to control its use for nefarious purposes and also curb its freedom as an independent entity. Just this month, the United Nations issued a statement whereby they announced that artificial intelligence is not currently in a position where it poses a significant threat, nor should it be managed or controlled with laws or regulations just yet. Many experts, however, think that it may be too late already. Part 1. Emergence. Let me begin by sharing with you an organization that has shaped my research into this subject. As part of my research into this episode, I consulted with the experts at the Center for Humane Technology. They are a non-profit organization dedicated to radically reimagining the digital infrastructure, and they're based out of San Francisco in California. Its founders, Tristan Harris and Arza Raskin, are world-renowned experts on artificial intelligence and its impact on society and mankind. They have advised Google and Apple, spoken on 60 Minutes, advised Facebook and YouTube, discussed their advocacy with US state governors, published articles in the New York Times, The Atlantic, Wired, The Wall Street Journal, and Forbes. They have both individually delivered successful TED Talks and given advice on the subject of AI to Congress and delivered state of technology updates to directors of national security in the United States. They both feature on the Forbes 30 Notable People Under 30 list, the Rolling Stones 25 People Changing the Future list, and their organization is listed on Fortune 25's Ideas That Will Change the World. They are quite literally the most advanced thinkers and experts in the field of artificial intelligence observation and control. And they are very, very concerned. Now, let me share with you first of all a stark statistic that was provided by the Center for Humane Technology. Quote, "The top 50 of artificial intelligence researchers believe that there is a 10% or greater chance that humans will go extinct directly due to our inability to control AI." Unquote. Let me repeat that quote for you again. Quote, "The top 50 of artificial intelligence researchers believe that there is a 10% or greater chance that humans will go extinct directly due to our inability to control AI." Unquote. In January of 2021, there were, give or take a dozen or so, around 100 teams researching the possibilities that AI technology could harvest. In January of 2024, that number had become around 10 to 15 million teams of researchers or independent developers globally who were working on pushing AI to the next level of advancement. This 150,000% increase in interest can be directly attributed to the 2017 Transformer AI architecture, which was developed by Google following their, quote, "Attention is all you need," unquote, research paper. "Attention is all you need" was a landmark research paper that was authored by 8 scientists at Google in 2017. The purpose of the paper was to expand on an earlier paper from 2014 relating to attention mechanisms and expanding on that and developing into a new deep learning architecture known as the Transformer. The paper was a watershed moment in the history of modern artificial intelligence, as transformers became the main architecture of known language models. Initially, the focus of the research was on improving SEQ to SEQ techniques for machine translation. But in their paper, the authors saw the potential for other tasks like question answering and for what is now called multimodal generative AI. Language, the scientists proposed, was the key to all artificial intelligence models, and they were right. It quite literally changed the game overnight. In popular culture, and in referential quotes, the paper was the Miles Dyson at Cyberdyne moment, for those of you familiar with the 1991 movie Terminator 2 Judgment Day. Nothing like it had come before, and the moment that it dropped was like someone opening up a huge dam. The metaphorical floodwaters were overwhelming, and now there's no turning back. But before I get to that point, let's start at the very beginning. How did we get here, and how did it all start? To start at the beginning, we need to go back to February the 4th, 2004. That was the day that Mark Zuckerberg launched the Facebook.com, a website that was created to connect people who attended Harvard University. Yes, there had been social networking websites before it, Classmates.com, LunarStorm, Bolt, LiveJournal, Friendster, Hi5, Zing, and MySpace, to name just a small few. But the Facebook, or Facebook as it later became known, would go further than social networking had gone before. Initially, Facebook seemed like all the other internet-based social platforms. It was primitive, aimed at teenagers, and pretty non-eventful. On screen, the website contained a photograph, some basic personal information, and a wall that your friends or connections could leave comments on. It was an ad-free and plain white and blue website. Initially, the expectation was that it would blend in amongst all the other social networks, and that very much was the case for the first 4 or 5 years of its operation. So let's fast forward a little bit. Since 2015, almost 70% of the early core developers of Facebook have left their roles due to their concerns of a beast that has grown from the early model ideas they had a hand in creating. That statistic also applies to Instagram, Twitter, Pinterest, and Google. There has been somewhat of an exodus in their staffing. The early system developers had noble ideas for what they were creating. Whilst initially social media was used as a way to stay in touch and interact with friends, to connect with others and grow your personal network, they soon identified more positive uses for the platform. They reunited lost family members, and they found organ donors. They brought like-minded individuals together who perhaps would never have found each other and formed meaningful groups, clubs, and charities. But, much like anything else that you release into the public domain, these things take on a life of their own, and they evolve in good ways and bad. Tristan Harris, the director and co-founder of the Center for Humane Technology, said this, quote,
"If you ask people what's wrong in the tech industry right now, there's a cacophony of grievances and scandals. Things such as, they stole our data. There's a societal tech addiction. There is so much fake news. There is such cultural polarization. There are elections that are getting hacked. But is there something that is beneath all these problems? Something that's causing all these things to happen? Happen all at once. When you look around you, it feels like the world is going crazy. You have to ask yourself, is this normal? Or have we all fallen under some kind of spell? When I was employed at Google, I worked on the Gmail development team, and I started getting burnt out in my role. It was because we had so many conversations about what the inbox should look like, what color it should be, and various design issues like that. I found it fascinating that there was no one at Google as part of the Gmail department who was working on making email less addictive. I questioned why no one else was thinking about this. I didn't hear anybody talking about this issue. I was feeling this frustration with the tech industry overall that we had lost our way. I struggled to try and figure out how we could change it. And that was when I decided to make a presentation, a call to arms. So every day I went home and I worked on the presentation for a couple hours every single night. I basically just said that never before in history have 50 young designers made decisions that would have an impact on more than 2 billion people. 2 billion people will have thoughts that they didn't intend to have because a designer at Google said, "This is how notifications work on that screen that you wake up to in the morning." And we have a moral responsibility as Google for solving this problem. I sent this presentation to about 20 of my closest colleagues at Google. I was very nervous about it. I wasn't sure it was going to land. Later that day, there was around 400 simultaneous viewers, and it kept growing and growing. I got emails from all around the company, people in every department who were saying they totally agreed. They were saying, "I see this affecting my kids. I see this affecting the people around me. We have to do something about this." I felt like I was launching a revolution or something like that. Later, I found out Larry Page, the CEO of Google at the time, had been notified about my presentation in 3 separate meetings that day. And so it created this cultural moment that Google needed to take seriously. And then nothing.
Tristan's comments here are echoed by large numbers of ex-Silicon Valley developers who worked at the big tech firms. What Tristan evidences is that early on in the development of social media, concerns and working observations were being noticed, but they were not being challenged or given oversight. Tim Kendall, a former Facebook executive and president of Pinterest, stated in a 29 interview that, quote,
"Everyone in 2006, including all of us at Facebook, had total admiration for Google. What Google had built, which was this incredibly useful service that did lots of good for the world. And they built this parallel money machine. We had such envy for that. It seemed so elegant to us. And so perfect. Facebook had been around for about 2 years. I was hired to come in and figure out what the business model was going to be for the company. I was the director of monetization. And as such, I was the person who was going to figure out how Facebook could monetize. I was one of the people who was pointing towards the suggestion that we have to make money. And I think this Google-like advertising model is probably the most elegant way of doing that."
This decision by Kendall essentially began a domino effect across other social media platforms. The big tech firms, your Google, your Facebook, your Instagram, are some of the wealthiest and most successful businesses of all time. Their annual turnovers are in the billions. In fact, Apple, Microsoft, Google, and Facebook are all in the top 50 wealthiest businesses in the world. And they have relatively few employees, too. In basic terms, they run powerful computers that generate all this money, right? But what exactly are they being paid for? Well, that's a really important question. And the answer, simply put, is you. Silicon Valley and the companies who operate therein has historically always made products such as computer hardware and software and sold them to their customers. This has been the core structure for the initial 50 years since 1955 when Shockley Semiconductor's laboratory opened its doors as the first tech firm in the valley. But all that changed from the late 2000s though, due in part to Tim Kendall's decision. For the last 15 years, the companies in Silicon Valley have evolved their business models, changing what they sell from physical objects and items to selling their users. In the most clear and basic terms, the big tech firm's model is thus. We, as users, don't pay for the products that we use, those products being the social media websites and apps. We don't pay because advertisers pay for the products that we use, because it's the advertisers who are the customers of the big tech firms, not us. We are the commodity. We are the item that's being sold. The general perception is that Google is just a search engine. Facebook is just an app where you can see what your friends are up to and look at their photos. But what is lesser understood is that these apps and websites are competing for your attention. Facebook, Snapchat, X, which we'll refer to as Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, well, all of these companies have the same core business model, and that is to keep people engaged on the screen as much as possible. they work to ensure that they get as much of the user's attention as they possibly can. How much time can they get you to spend? How much of your life can they get you to give away? There are many services on the internet that we perceive as being free, but they're not free. They are paid for by advertisers. Advertisers pay the big tech firms in exchange for showing their ads to us. Simple when you think about it, right? We are the product, our attention is the product being sold to the advertisers. That's the base business marker. Things quickly evolve from that base marker, though. The base market is far too simplistic now. So how did they build on that? Well, they can show everyone an ad, right? But what's better than a general or average ad campaign? Well, to make it targeted, to guarantee a greater success rate to the campaign. If you're a car dealership and looking to sell cars, lots and lots of cars, it makes sense to aim your ad campaign to people who are currently looking to buy a car, right? Or at least, people who are old enough to drive and who have a valid driver's license. That narrows your pool and takes the ad to the right people. But how does an advertiser work out who is old enough to drive and who has a valid driver's license and who is currently shopping for a new car? Well, that's where social media comes in. They have and know this information about you, and it's very valuable to the right advertisers. And that's the product, you, and your data. But what if not only knowing all about you, your habits and your interests, what if they could change all those things about you, when they like, and without you ever knowing? Changing what you do, how you think, who you are. Gradual changes, slight modifications. This is a goldmine to businesses, and more than they could ever dream of. I guarantee that if it conducts an ad campaign, it will be successful. Big tech sells that. They sell guarantees and certainty, something that has only been possible in the marketing industry in the last 15 years. Big tech can only make those guarantees, though, by having a hell of a lot of data. This is often referred to as surveillance capitalism, that being the practice of profiting off the infinite tracking of end users. This is a relatively new kind of marketplace, one that didn't exist prior to 2010. It's a marketplace that trades exclusively in human futures. A market that has produced the trillions of dollars that have made the internet companies the richest companies in the history of the world. It seems paranoid to suggest this, doesn't it? But it has been confirmed by individuals such as Edward Snowden, who understood it from a governmental perspective, but also from the social media developers themselves, such as Jeff Seibert, a former Twitter executive before Elon Musk took control of the business. In a 2020 interview, Seibert stated, quote,
"Everything people are doing online is being logged. It's being tracked and is being measured. Every single action you take is carefully and digitally monitored and recorded. For example, exactly what images you stop and look at, and for how long you look at those images. How you interact with the image. If you like the image, or leave a comment on that image, or tag someone in that image. They know when people are lonely. They know when people are depressed. They know when people are looking at photos of their ex-romantic partners. They know what you are doing late at night. They know the entire thing. They can identify whether you are an introvert or an extrovert, what kind of neuroses you have, what your personality type is like. They have more information about us than has ever been imagined in human history. It is unprecedented."
And all of this data about who we are, that we are just pouring out all of the time, is being fed into these systems that have no human supervision and that are making better and better predictions about what we are going to do and who we are. They are amassing personal data to a point that your individual algorithm knows you better than you know yourself. A lot of people have the misconception that it's our data being sold. It's not in Facebook's business interest to give up the data. That is their business value. So what do they do with your data? Well, they build models that predict our actions. Now, these comments by Seibert may be hard to digest, particularly the part where he states that the system algorithm knows you better than yourself. but sadly it is true. It has been tested under laboratory conditions. Because without internal self-influence and inner self-perception, our behaviors and habits boil down to simple data, whether we perceive ourselves to be in a certain way or not. An example of this might be pop music, for example. The algorithm can easily detect what you listen to the most, your favorite artist, favorite songs, and musical genres. When asked by a friend, "Hey, what kind of music do you like listening to?" you might respond with, "Oh, I like rock music and heavy metal." You sound cool. That's the image you have of yourself. And that's what you consider to be your genuine music taste. But the algorithm has months or even years of your music taste data. And if asked the same question, it might say, "Sure, he likes rock music, but he also has a hidden passion for boy bands in there too," purely assessing the data on an average basis, of course. You might not consider yourself to like boy bands, but occasionally a boy band song might come on the radio or a shuffled playlist, and maybe you'll like it, even if it's on a subliminal level. How would the algorithm know, though? Well, did you skip this song and not skip others? Did you hit repeat after it ended? Did you add it to a playlist? Have you visited that song multiple times over a lengthy period of time? Has someone commented about that song on social media, resulting in you liking the comment? Have you liked a poster of the band? Have you searched for the song on a search engine? Have you checked yourself in at a gig, etc., etc.? Sure, this is a basic and fun example, but you get the idea. Now, the algorithm, to be clear when talking about the logging, tracking, and monitoring of your personal data, is not that the big tech firm have a paper file on all of us or an avatar for every human, but what it is that your data is encoded in a colossal mainframe. All of the things we've ever done, all of the clicks you've ever made, all the videos you've watched, all the likes you have made, that all gets added to your personal record and algorithm to continually polish and maintain a more and more accurate digital model of you. That model, once established, can predict every kind of thing that that person does. It can predict what kind of videos will keep you watching, what kinds of emotions tend to trigger you, personal tastes in everything from music to movies to fashion to other types of people, to jobs, to holidays, to politics, the list is endless. Everything that your algorithm knows about you, it then uses to produce what you see and the ads and information that you are presented with. Did you know that the social media apps that you have on your smartphone has access to your phone's microphone? And the terms and conditions that you sign when you agree to your social media account allows those apps to track and log the data that it has from your phone's microphone. This is when you are not on a phone call and your phone is in your pocket, for example. What the app tracks you as saying is then fed into the algorithm. It only takes a few months of data to get a 100% accurate model of an average person. And when you think about it, most people have now got 10 years plus feeding into multiple social media platforms. You, as a product, are being fine-tuned every single waking moment, and there is an exact model of you logged. At the main technology companies, there are three main goals. Number one, the engagement goal, to drive up the user's usage and to keep you scrolling. Number two, there's the growth goal, to keep the user coming back and inviting as many friends as you can to join you. And number three, there's the advertising goal, to make sure that while all of this is happening, the tech firm is making as much money as possible from pushing ads onto you. Each of these goals are powered by algorithms whose job it is to figure out what to show you to keep those numbers going up and up. Now, just to be clear, none of the information that I have shared with you tonight is kept secret. It has been openly shared by several ex-employees of the big tech organizations, none of which have denied the claims when exposed. The practices and procedures used by the big tech firms in their core business models are entirely in the public domain. But through the ever-evolving methods demonstrated by big tech, we have created a world in which online connection has become primary, and especially for younger generations. And yet, in that world, anytime two people connect, The way it's financed is through a hidden third person who is manipulating those two people for monetary gain. We have created an entire global generation of people who were raised within a context whereby the very meaning of communication and the very meaning of culture is manipulation. We have allowed deceit and deception at the center of everything we do, and we have allowed ourselves to be harvested and challenged. Psychology. Those of you who listen to this podcast regularly will know my area of expertise is psychology. When I was researching this subject, I was pleased to find out just how much psychology played a part in this subject matter. And in lieu of this, allow me to present you with a brief analogy. Magicians, particularly those who practice mentalism or mind magic, were a sort of early neuroscientist or psychologist when they were at their peak of popularity in the 19th century. They were professionals and experts who understood how their audiences' minds work long before psychology became a common scientific practice. In real time, they were testing many techniques and methods on their audience members during their routines. The magician understands a part of your mind that you are not aware of or paying attention to in that specific moment. And that's what makes the illusion work. Mental misdirection. Doctors, lawyers, scientists, all very educated and intelligent people are completely unaware to the methods used in a mental magician's routine. They don't know any more about how their own mind is vulnerable than anyone else. Intelligence and education is no shield or barrier. That's a separate discipline, and it's a discipline that applies to all human beings. As a fun aside, and if you have a spare moment, look up the British mind magician named Derren Brown on YouTube. There are plenty of videos showing his tricks. He's one of the best in his field. See if you can work out how he is doing what he does as it is happening. Anyway, with this perspective, you can have a very different understanding of what technology is actually doing. I mention this because in late 2009, both Facebook and Google were actively recruiting large numbers of psychologists to join their staff in the aid of developing their business model. How could a psychologist contribute to the development of a computer system, you say? Well, the answer is in development and informing of the algorithm. One ex-staff member of Facebook, who chose to remain anonymous, gave these following comments. He stated that he was poached to join Facebook from the Stanford Persuasive Technology Lab, now known as the Stanford Behavior Design Lab. Anyway, the laboratory's mission goal is to study factors that impact human behaviors and conduct research into influence models. The staff member, upon joining Facebook, was tasked with implementing the use of everything we know about the psychology of what persuades people and to build that into their technology. Thus, Facebook's own system is structured to influence human behaviors based on their core psychological makeup. Persuasive technology is designed intentionally and applied to the extreme where we really want to modify and influence someone's behavior. So for example, if they want the user to keep refreshing the page, they will incorporate persuasive technology. You pull the screen down and it refreshes the page. There will be a new thing to read or interact with at the top. Pull down and refresh again, fresh content again. Ever wonder why, when you do this on Facebook or Twitter, it doesn't automatically refresh to the most recent item posted by someone you follow? If it did, it would show you the same things over and over if you kept refreshing. But they don't want that. They need to keep you engaged. So, it's new every single time, which in psychology terms is called a positive intermittent reinforcement. You don't know when you are going to get the reward. You don't know if you are going to get the reward. The reward, in this example, being new content that's pleasing to you. This scenario operates just like the slot machines in Las Vegas. It's not enough to use this product consciously. The system is designed to dig down deeper into the brainstem and plant a habit inside of you. An unconscious habit so that you are programmed at a deeper level. You don't even realize it's happened. Some people might consider themselves above this or impervious to these tactics, but they aren't. No one is. it's a human trait that your brain comes pre-formatted with. This is how notifications work, and news feeds, and status updates, and suggestions for things that you might like, and so on. So you play the slot machines to see what you get, right? You engage because the outcome might be positive. Win. A small drop of serotonin. That's not by accident. That's a system design technique. Another example is photo tagging. You might receive an email that says that your friend just tagged you in a photograph. Of course, you're going to click on that email, log into your social media account, and take a look at that photograph. It's not something you can just decide to ignore. This taps into a deep-seated human psychological trait. You've been manipulated based on your own psychological makeup. That's incredibly hard to resist or undo. Ever wonder why that email notification doesn't just include the photograph in it? But it's not all about the photo. And hey, as you've logged into your account to check the photo, you might as well check all this other stuff out too, right, while you're there. By the way, don't forget to like and comment on that photo. And here's an ad while you do it too. Now, Facebook, Google, Pinterest, Twitter, they all employ entire teams dedicated to the discipline and specialized field called growth hacking. Essentially, groups of engineers whose job it is to hack or manipulate the user's psychology. Thus, they can get more growth. They can get more user signups, more engagement. They can get you to invite more of your friends. With the ultimate end goal being to sell you as the product to advertisers to make money. Fun fact. In January 2012, Facebook conducted what they called a massive-scale contagion experiment on an anonymous group of its users. About 700,000 of its users, to be specific. The experiment used subliminal cues on Facebook pages to directly manipulate their users' emotions and trigger emotion responses. Facebook didn't give its users informed consent for the experiment, thus breaking significant ethical rules and regulations. The experiment hid certain elements from 689,003 users' news feeds over the course of 1 week. The experiment hid a small percentage of emotional words from users' news feeds without their knowledge to test what effect that it had on the statuses or likes that the users then posted or reacted to. The results found that the users' emotions were reinforced by what they saw, or what the researchers called emotional contagion. Facebook concluded, emotions expressed by friends via online social networks influence our own moods, constituting the first experimental evidence for massive-scale emotional contagion via social networks. Facebook were also now confident that they could affect real-world behavior and emotions without ever triggering the user's awareness. To look at the common social media model at face value, it's exploiting a vulnerability in human psychology. The inventors, creators, and developers all understood this consciously, but did it anyway. With the knowledge we have now as to how things changed over time, the evolution has not been altered or provided with oversight, calling into question the moral and ethical policies of big tech. Do you check your smartphone while you are going to the restroom? Do you take your smartphone to bed with you? Do you scroll through your smartphone while you are eating dinner? Even worse, eating dinner at a restaurant, thus killing any conversation with your dinner guest. Do you check your smartphone while driving? So here's the thing. Social media is a drug, metaphorically and realistically. As a species, humans have a basic biological imperative to connect with other people that directly affects the release of dopamine in the neural reward pathway. Millions of years of evolution support that system to get us to come together and live in communities to find mates to propagate our species. It's basic human instinct and hardwired behavior, even for those people who consider themselves a loner or antisocial. So there's no doubt that a vehicle like social media, which optimizes and exploits this connection between people, is going to have the potential for significant addiction. And that is what we are seeing every known study. Part 2, The Transformer. So I have depressed you all with the harsh reality of social media sucking the life and soul out of society. But how does this connect to artificial intelligence? Well, artificial intelligence is such an abstract thing that it's so hard to wrap your head around how transformational it has become in such a short period of time. It's almost like the common perception of its capabilities are yet to catch up with the reality. Worryingly, it may take a major event for the common understanding to level up. You see, when you invent a new technology, you uncover a new class of responsibility, and it's not always obvious what those responsibilities are during the early stages of development. So to give an example, we didn't need the legal right to be forgotten, to be written into law, until computers could remember us forever. Now that storage is dirt cheap, it has become disposable, and disposable items are often given very little thought. In addition, if your newly invented technology confers power in some way, it will inevitably start a race. Power in any format is a basic human craving and desire. It never goes unnoticed or ignored. Never. Without coordination, agreements, and control, any power race will likely end in tragedy. So with that in mind, where are we on the artificial intelligence timeline? Well, in simple terms, we are entering stage two. The first stage of the development of AI is what we have just discussed, social media, or what's referred to as stage one, curation AI. Obtaining data, sorting data, exhibiting data, sharing data, influencing data. We are 15 years into that stage, and it has been perfected by big tech. Curation AI. The second stage of the development of AI is a phase we have recently entered. I say recently, over the last 2 or 3 years. This stage is called Stage 2, Creation AI. What comes under that is designing of data, modeling, complex ideas, data design, forming complex idea sets, and generative models. Now it's clear from what we have already spoken about so far in this episode that we let Stage 1 get away from us ever so slightly. The collective we, of course. It's out of control, and there's no putting it back in the box. So with that in mind, you can be sure that no one is going to move on to stage two and make the same mistakes again, right? Wrong. It's already snowballing. And from the data sets we have collected over the last 15 years and observing how we evolved stage one, we can make a reasonable assumption about where things will go wrong with stage two and the problems that we will face. So to recap, stage one hit us with issues concerning addiction, disinformation, mental health, polarization, censorship, and speech and manipulation. You have all seen those for yourself, right, online. You understand how they emerge from the social media structure and are with us in force today. Well, where is stage two going to take us? Actually, this is fairly easy to predict. You don't need to be a professor in chaos theory to know what issues are going to emerge within the next 10 years. Those issues are national security, media and journalism, personal identity, politics, elections, GDP, military confrontation, and social values. In addition, the collapse of trust and reality, heavy automation and digital self-awareness across all industries, law, weaponry, science, and lobbying. AI will make us more efficient, make us write faster, code faster, will resolve impossible scientific and medical problems, it will resolve climate change, and will make us a hell of a lot of money. In 2017, the Transformer AI was created at Google. Prior to this date, separate engines were used to complete tasks such as speech recognition, robotics, image generation, music and video generation, speech synthesis, and computer vision. Progress was fairly slow as the AI engines for each of these areas were built upon manually, bit by bit, by a small number of teams globally, each focusing on their own personal niche area. Speech synthesis only, for example, and so on. This was because the development and progress in each discipline was so different from each other that there was almost zero crossover between each discipline. Then, when the Transformer engine dropped in 2017, it changed the game because it combined all disciplines into one single focus point and did so under a singular methodology of a language model. Now that all AI research fed into the same pot, so to speak, it meant progress thundered forward faster than ever, with increased interest and funding, and resolved historical issues along the way, which only triggered more interest. Transformer was also unique and interesting because it didn't require the developers to enter the information and manually teach the AI brain. Transformer was just placed online and coded to learn for itself. In fact, the Transformer started with the equivalent of a 3-year-old human's brain. In the 2.5 years since that point, it now holds an intelligence level of a very educated and intelligent 19-year-old. It has taught itself to be instantly fluent in all known languages, including extinct or dead languages. Fun fact. A recent test run in San Francisco hooked a selection of human volunteers up to an MRI machine, and they showed the human subjects a selection of images. They asked the test subject to look carefully at the image and retain the image in their mind for a few moments. Simultaneously, the humans were hooked up to a neural scanner, which scanned the movement of blood in the humans' brains and translated the data into an image on a computer screen in another room. In 100% of the humans tested, the AI model replicated the images that the humans had seen from scanning their brains and mind's eye alone. So when you dream, your visual cortex runs in reverse. So this means certainly that in the next 1 or 2 years, we'll be able to start decoding dreams. The use for law enforcement as a visual lie detector and for military and espionage purposes are also pretty clear too. This same experiment proved to also work on a human's inner monologue. So transferring a series of events or footage, so to speak, and turn that into a written account or timeline of events. It's crazy, right? Other examples are vocal commands into AI engines asking the model to identify weakness in system securities and for the AI to write a code to exploit that security weakness. This was recently tested on an isolated US Department of Defense system, and the computer hacked into the system within 90 seconds and locked the owners out in another 10. Do you want passport or government ID documents for literally any country? AI can knock together perfect replicas with functioning security features within 30 seconds. These are, of course, more nefarious uses, but with good always comes bad. Let's take voice and video synthesizing. Currently, AI can learn 100% audio accurate vocal cloning in just 3 seconds of audio to duplicate. I know this works because this entire episode has been read by an AI engine on my computer. I haven't recorded a single second of audio of my voice for this episode. Could you tell? The synthesization also works for images and video, and is currently extremely limited to avoid widespread political disinformation in an election year. But it's doable. But that's an early onset problem. If you can generate any image or video that looks perfectly real of anything, and you can generate any sound or noise with complete accuracy, there will be a point very soon, and some scientists predict this will be within the next 12 months, that we won't be able to tell reality from fiction online anymore. The knock-on effects of what that could cause or be used for is very, very worrying. But it's coming, be sure. We can't really stop it at this point. We are currently in the era of the total decoding and synthesization of humanity and culture. AI already has all our information and data it's got from all of our social media. Now it's duplicating and creating things, including versions of us. We'll come back to this point shortly. But first I want to talk about AI emergent capabilities. These are elements that the AI engine has become entirely competent or even an expert in without being programmed, asked, or directed to by any human. So we know that the way the AI model works is that it just consumes massive volumes of data, stores it, learns it, and retains it. This pertains to anything in any subject or area of knowledge or any skill set. Scientists actually discovered the AI was capable of this more than 2 years after the Transformer engine was released. They'd always dealt with the model in English, and all information entered into the engine early on was in English. When it connected to the internet, it was pointed in the direction of all English language data. Then in 2023, when a scientist at Google was having some fun with the engine and entering fun commands, the AI started responding to him in fluent Aymara, which is a language only spoken in Peru and Bolivia. Following an investigation, the scientists had realized the engine was actually aware of all known languages and could respond in them. In 2022, the same scientists also identified that the AI engine had taught itself college-grade research chemistry. And there's almost certainly more information and expertise in the digital mind than we are currently aware of, but we just don't have the technology to find out what. The digital brain has surpassed our levels of automated analysis already. Developers at Google added an additional function to the AI engine in 2023, a feature called Whisper. This effectively gave the AI the ability to watch videos, movies, TV, and listen to radio and podcasts. This is so the model can, as well as learning information, also take it from culture and reality. Can you see where all this is going? Scientists will be able to provide an exact date by the end of this year, 2024, for when they expect artificial intelligence to awaken or become self-aware. It's expected to be within the next 5 to 10 years. Some institutions, however, like universities and research laboratories, are restricting and removing certain information from the internet so that the AI engine cannot obtain it or learn it. There are numerous teams out there working to restrict knowledge online to high school level, and also pump large amounts of disinformation and incorrect data into the public domain to purposefully hinder the progress of AI. Commentators feel this is too little too late, however. Although this will contribute to the evolving issues set out by stage 2 of AI development, which we spoke about earlier. I'm going to summarize. I think, with all the puzzle pieces that I have laid out on tonight's metaphorical table, each of you listening can see clearly where the future of AI and humans is heading. Eventually, computers with artificial intelligence will replace humans in making important decisions and taking important actions, because the error rate and accuracy of a computer is far better performatively than the human error accuracy rate. We simply don't like to admit or accept that, but it's true. We have known that for a long time. It's why trials of driverless cars amuse me so much. The tech is there for it to work perfectly, but because humans don't like not being in control, or to admit that the AI will drive the car better than them, there has been significant pushback from residents in cities where it has been trialed. Even more amusing are the teams developing the programs and how they are deliberately dragging their feet. Torn between the cultural imagery of driverless cars and knowing that the program will fare far better than manually driven cars. It is, of course, the automobile lobby too. Paying people off so that your business get what it wants is no joke in the United States. At some point, the AI is going to disagree with humans, or identify better ways for us to be doing things, and will challenge us. Humans might take the information and data on board and work with the AI to evolve and improve. Although, let's be completely honest here. There is also a strong chance that humans might push back, insistent on being the alpha in the relationship, which by then might not actually be the case. The particular worry being politics and military use. I would like to think that it could lead to more honesty in politics and less military confrontation and war, given the intelligence stance on regarding both of these issues. But it might learn emotion, personal gain, greed, power, and a multitude of other negative personality traits by that point too. Ultimately, right now, big tech owns every piece of information and data about you that there is. Most of you might already have been aware of that fact, and maybe just try to put it out of your thoughts. But it does. Roughly 54% of the global population own and use a smartphone. So that at least is half of our planet pumping some sort of data into online retention systems. Remember, big tech also has the ability to influence and manipulate you through its social media algorithm. It affects and impacts almost 93% of your daily actions on average. Now, with that knowledge, know that you and everything about you is online in data form and is manipulatable. Then think what happens when artificial intelligence gets access to all that data and the ability to control it. Good night, everybody.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to our show tonight. Be sure to leave us a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform and subscribe to our show so that you never miss an episode. Our shows aren't sponsored by any company or corporation, so any support you can give us goes a long way in supporting the work that we do. From all of us here at Dead Souls, sleep tight.